written by Patrick Donnelly Frost, narrated by Camila Brennan. First recorded 2026, and now, Iron Road. Kerala Jirgu, the dream of a continent crossed at 11:30 on the morning of May 10, 1869, two locomotives stood facing each other on a narrow strip of track in the Utah desert. Separated by a gap of less than a rail's length, on the western side sat the Central Pacific's Jupiter, a wood-burning 4-4-0 engine decorated with flags and bunting, its polished brass fittings gleaming under a clear spring sky. On the eastern side stood the Union Pacific's No. 119, darker and heavier, a coal burner that had hauled supplies and dignitaries across the Wyoming plains. Between them lay a final tie of polished California laurelwood and four ceremonial spikes, two of gold, one of silver, one of a gold-silver-iron alloy that would complete the first continuous rail line across North America. Promontory Summit, Utah Territory, sits at an elevation of 4,905 feet on a barren ridge north of the Great Salt Lake. It was not a town and would not become one. The Union Pacific had assembled a grandstand of sorts, a construction train fitted with a speaker's platform, and several hundred people had gathered, a crowd that was in equal parts laborers, engineers, politicians, journalists, and the merely curious. Leland Stanford, president of the Central Pacific and former governor of California, stood on one side of the gap. Thomas C. Durant, the Union Pacific's vice president, stood on the other. Both men had traveled to this desolate spot aboard private cars stocked with food and champagne, understanding that they were present at one of the defining moments of the century. The telegraph wires told the story's scale. Lines running from Promontory Summit connected to Salt Lake City, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Washington, and Boston. Operators in those cities had been alerted to stand by. When the final spike was driven, the telegraph would send a single signal, the word done, and church bells, cannon fire, and public celebrations would erupt simultaneously across the continent. In San Francisco, the fire bell at City Hall had been wired directly to the telegraph circuit. In New York, Trinity Church's bells were ready. In Washington, a ball atop the Capitol dome was rigged to drop the moment the signal came. Stanford swung a silver-headed maul at the golden spike and missed. Durant swung and also missed. Both men had been drinking. A railroad worker drove the actual spikes home, and at 12:47 p.m., the telegraph operator tapped out the signal. Done. The continent was crossed. What that word announced was the culmination of a vision that had lived in American imaginations for four decades. Men had dreamed of a railroad to the Pacific since the 1830s, when the technology was barely a decade old, and California was still part of Mexico. The dream had survived sectional conflict, two competing visions of American destiny, the incompetence and greed of the men entrusted to build it, blizzards in the Sierra Nevada, and 5 years of war. It had been built by approximately 20,000 workers, Irish immigrants who had fled famine, Chinese immigrants who had come seeking gold and stayed to build a railroad, Civil War veterans on both sides, freedmen, Mormons, and men who left no names in any record. Most of the men who actually drove the spikes and graded the roadbed and hung suspended in baskets over sheer cliff faces to drill blasting holes would not appear in the famous photograph taken that day at Promontory Summit. They had already dispersed to find the next job, or returned to San Francisco's Chinatown, or moved on to wherever displaced men go when the work is finished. The two locomotives facing each other across the last gap, the champagne, the telegraphs, those were for the men who had financed and organized and profited. The men who had built it were already gone. The Visigoth, 1830 to 1862. Chapter 1. The Dream. Asa Whitney and the Transcontinental Vision. In the winter of 1844, a New York dry goods merchant named Asa Whitney returned from 2 years of trading in China with a conviction that would consume the remaining decades of his life. Whitney had watched the China trade. Silks, porcelain, tea, flow around the Cape of Good Hope and across the Atlantic to American and European markets, a journey of 5 to 6 months each way. He had also observed that the United States, sitting between the Atlantic and the Pacific, was geographically positioned to become the middleman of global commerce, the entrepot through which the goods of Asia moved to Europe and back. The obstacle was obvious. There was no reliable way to cross the continent. Whitney came home with a plan to build one. Whitney's proposal, submitted to Congress in January 1845, was specific in both geography and finance. He wanted to build a railroad from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or from some point on Lake Michigan, westward to the mouth of the Columbia River on the Pacific